The competition for good trained tech workers is stiff and getting stiffer. That is a major challenge facing our state. The focus of a conference and expo at the Hawaii Convention Center is on our tech force. How do we prepare our young people for the high-demand, high-technology jobs for the future? Scott Godwin is the general manager of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. It's a research center that looks at everything from cybersecurity to data science. Goodwin previously worked for 15 years at Microsoft. He's in town to talk about the kind of skill sets we will need for the next generation of workers.
It seems like that wheel is spinning faster and faster. I'm continually amazed not only at technology innovation, how fast it's coming, but the associated drop in price and what that means for education and really putting it in the touch of everyday Americans and how we can use that to advance new business models and new businesses in general.
So what do we need to look for or look out for as we try and prepare this, you know, next workforce?
So many of our universities are moving at a pace that does not match industry and industry evolution, technology innovation, and so we're not educating to the current technology levels. And so I think each university's got to kind of make that call for themselves of what are those trends that they're going to specify and grow in, and then make those targeted investments accordingly. I think the other thing that we're trying to do from a national lab perspective is making sure that our scientists that are working in these areas are also volunteering as adjunct professors so that we can come alongside academic programs and help make it relevant and make it practical for students today.
Yeah, I think that's a really big deal because, you know, we see the changes coming so fast. Government is having a hard time as far as the regulation side of it. And then there are just so many threats that seem to be coming from all directions, you know, with cybersecurity and you know, with everybody on the internet, and it's just like, yikes.
Yeah, and I think with new innovations, it makes it even harder. So, you know, we saw this happen with cloud innovation when everybody was running to the cloud 3, 4, 5 years ago because of cost savings and being able to get out of running my own data center. But we weren't thinking about security at the time, and so security lagged. I think we're seeing the same thing happen in things like 5G, where everyone's running to it because of what it means for the Internet of Things, what it means for connected devices, but we've really got to address that security layer. And so I'm hoping that we can learn from things like the cloud and do that much quicker and sooner in that curve.
What's the biggest challenge you think that, you know, local governments and schools face?
I think for most schools, oftentimes, and local governments, it comes down to money. You know, they have limited dollars to invest, and with these curves coming so fast and their normal process moving much slower, how do I insert myself into that technology wave, and what are the right ones to jump on, and how do I do that with very limited funds? I think that only happens through partnership. I think we've got to think about this public-private partnership much differently. We've got to think about how we engage with industry leaders. I know that's something that we as a national lab have been dealing with. You know, we've been historically over the last several decades very insular. You know, we only did work for the federal government and their those customers. And we've had to develop new contractual mechanisms that allow us to put our people and our facilities to work for industry, to aggressively pursue some of those partnerships. And I think that's made a big difference in how we're able to stay in front of it.
I know as far as the data that's being collected, there are fields that are emerging, you know, when it comes to mining that data.
We're producing data far faster than we can analyze it, and so that's bringing on the advent of things like machine learning and AI to be able to allow machine learning in that space and on those data sets. But the key question, I think, always comes down to is for what purpose? What do we want to use it for? What's the intended goal? Data analytics is a huge area, obviously being driven by, you know, some of the big companies in this space, Facebook, Google. And so data analytics is an enormous field. We, as a national lab, play in this space, but are constantly competing to keep the talent, the limited talent that exists. You know, I shared this statistic with some folks recently from the state that I'm from, in Washington State, and our Washington State universities are producing about 1,800 graduates a year in computing generally. About 800 of those 1,800 are going on to pursue their master's degree or some advanced education. So we've only got about 1,000 that are entering the workforce, and yet in my state alone we have 75,000 open jobs in computing. So, you know, this is not a unique challenge for Washington State. It's not only across the United States, but it's a global challenge. You know, we've got to work with universities to produce this kind of talent more effectively in greater numbers, but we've also got to think differently about how we approach it. And I think some of the work that we're doing in things like AI are going to be part of the answer, at least in the short term. You know, I mentioned the public-private partnership, and I think this is something that, unlike maybe times in the past, industry is highly engaged and highly interested in working with universities, because they're the ones that need the talent, right? And so it's forcing everyone to think differently about the traditional talent paths that we've pursued, the type of students that we've pursued, even down to our work environments, that it's not a traditional work setting where you come to an office building, that we're now quite comfortable with folks working from wherever they're at. And so it's shaking up everything from non-traditional work environments to the staff that we pursue and how we grow talent.
Do you think Hawaii has any particular challenges?
I've heard, I have a lot of friends here in Hawaii, and we talk a lot about the Hawaiian culture and how that can be a different mindset or thought process that's a barrier to engagement with the mainland. But I don't know that I see those challenges. I think instead what I see is assets here in Hawaii that are very unique, that can be an exemplar for the entire country. And so whether that's, you know, leveraging the DoD assets and relationships that exist here and the kind of internships that can be created with the Department of Defense, whether we look at critical infrastructure that's here that is fairly isolated, like HECO, for example, and the electric, and saying, you know, this is a place where we could test advanced capabilities, we could grow talent in this space, and it could have application much broader when we think about a national kind of challenge or national impact.
You know, I know here in Hawaii we've always had to deal with the lower salaries and a higher cost of living, and that's been a problem, you know, with the brain drain, because a lot of our young people do go off for education, and they, you know, maybe stay and get some experience, but they know that if they want to come back here to Hawaii, they will have to take a pay cut. And so that makes it hard to keep that reliable workforce when the salaries aren't, when they're behind, you know, the continent.
Right. Yeah, I confess that I have not heard that as much. When I got my undergraduate quite a while ago now, many of my fellow students were Hawaiian and have since moved back to Hawaii, and I think that's kind of the more fundamental thing that I hear from them, is a desire to be back home. And I think with the changes in today's workforce, that's quite possible, that they could work for a company that might be based in the mainland, but work from here. And I think there's use cases to be developed that are Hawaii-specific that could be very interesting.
That was Scott Godwin of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. He'll be speaking at the Tech Force Hawaii Conference and Expo being held at the Convention Center tomorrow.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum's Spineless Wonders, Rising from the Deep, an exploration of marine invertebrates and their deep-sea environment, now open. bishopmuseum.org.
You know, the National Park Service has had quite a year here in Hawaii. On the Big Island, it's been inundated by lava and beset by an assortment of invasive species. With so much active science swirling around, the Park Service decided to try its hand at podcasting. It kicks off a half a dozen episodes this month. Here's a clip from one of those episodes.
20 years ago, the first Kochi frogs hitched a ride to the islands on some potted plants, then dispersed into the native forests. Because they're prolific breeders, the frogs quickly invaded the ecosystem. Now the park is trying to eradicate the Kochi, partly because their loud calls have become a big problem for the island's residents.
That was the unmistakable chirp of the frog found in Hawaii's national parks on the Big Island. It's the focus of a podcast by the National Park Service. Spokeswoman Jessica Farrakhan tells us the idea was hatched back in 2017 with a team from the Park Service Colorado Natural Resource Stewardship and Science Division.
You know as well as I do that Hawaii has the dubious distinction of being the endangered species capital of the world. So we had that story to tell and how the parks tackle that. And also, we wanted to get out there. You know, people think of national parks and they think of, you know, the wonderful flat hat and the ranger leading a hike. But there's a whole team of people who are educated, passionate, and committed to saving natural resources like Nene or keeping the soundscape silent, you know, trying to prevent the rising tide of the Kochi frog, trying to keep corals and other things healthy. So these podcasts tell that story through the audio.
And you folks have been battling a number of things, including lava.
Correct. Yes. In fact, when this team came out from Colorado and from Montana State University, we took them out to the lava lake with scientists from the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, went out to record the sounds of the lava lake, and that was very exciting. That was going to be its own podcast. We also took them out to see lava crossing the coastal plain near the coastline in Hawaii volcanoes. Of course, all of that went away last year when we had all this dramatic eruption and collapsing events happen, and so that story had to change a little bit, but I think that's the underlying theme of these podcasts is that Hawaii is all about change, and the lava that created these islands is also part of the destruction and the creation of them, and without it, we wouldn't have all these other animals and creatures and environments that we talk about in the podcast series.
And you folks have recently battled, I think, little fire ant, too.
Yes, and little fire ants don't make much noise, so they weren't quite the audio draw as, say, the Kochi frog. But talking about fire ants, that's actually been a pretty good success story here in Hawaii volcanoes. Our team has been diligent about treating the area at steam vents with the different methods that they're using to eradicate them, and I think they're getting close to a full eradication from that area. So that's a great story to tell.
Okay, well, that should be the subject of a podcast.
Yes, it should be. Actually, fire ants were not even we didn't know we had them in the park back in 2017 when we first started recording these audio stories. And back in 2017, we also only had a handful of Kochi frogs. Now it's getting more and more prevalent to hear them at nighttime in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, which is really kind of alarming because we are so accustomed to having this beautiful soundscape, this quiet nighttime area where you can hear, you know, the uwa'u, the Hawaiian petrel, and other natural noises. But to hear that peaceful nighttime shattered from these little noisy frogs is really upsetting.
Well, now, you have then just launched this six-part series. Is there hope that there'll be more?
Yes. So the Colorado team that came out, the Natural Resource Stewardship and Science folks, they really want Hawaii's stories to launch more from around the national parks. It was really easy for them to come to Hawaii because we have so many national parks on Hawaii Island, as well as different stories. Each park has different issues that they are facing, whether it's coral bleaching, you know, off the coast of the Kona Coast at Koloko Honokahau, or success stories like the Koloko Fish Ponds and the perpetuation of these Hawaiian fish ponds and rock walls that protect them. So there's a great geographical advantage that told some really fascinating cultural and natural resource stories here in Hawaii.
So I guess is the idea that then folks can tap these podcasts as they plan their trip to Hawaii to learn more about, you know, some of these national parks that they can visit?
Yeah, I think these are for not just visitors, but also our local residents. A lot of people don't realize that maybe, you know, back in the 1950s, Nene, for instance, we were down to 30 birds. And the park started a captive breeding program in the 70s. Now, instead of being down to, you know, 30 birds, there are up to 3,000 Nene statewide and about 250 located in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. So these stories aren't just for the visitor to the national park, but they're also for local residents and students as well. These are really great modules for students to listen to.
Well, I think it'd be wonderful. It's a wonderful complement to, you know, the fourth grade science trip to the Big Island that everybody takes.
Yeah, absolutely. These are going to be helpful in the classroom. And also, if you have a long drive, you know, these episodes are about 10 minutes each. They're fascinating. And the audio on them is very, very well done. You can hear the Nene cooing when Kathleen Misahan, our wildlife biologist, was out at the Inaho section of the park where there's a preserve for Nene. You can hear the calls of the Io or the endangered Hawaiian stilt at Kaloko Honokahau. So the sounds are just, they really tell the story as well as the words from the resource workers who are interviewed for these stories.
So do you have a favorite of this first six?
Well, I can tell you my least favorite, and that's because I live in an area which is riddled with koki frog, and it's a great story. They interview Kim Dillman, our kokistador, we call her in the park, but it's a little bit anxiety-causing because I live surrounded by koki frog, and when I hear their noises in the daytime listening to the podcast, it sort of creeps me out. But, yeah, they're all really good. I really enjoyed listening to Sally Beavers talk about coral bleaching, and it seems like a hopeless situation, but she really restores the faith that we can address this on an individual level. You know, everybody says think global, act local, but it, you know, some of these conservation stories, you can get a glimmer of hope and act that way and do the right thing and reduce your plastics and your carbon offset. So they're all really great.
Well, is there anything that surprised you when you listened to them?
You know, we close out the series with kind of a lava meditation. We had to change the kind of the story of the lava because there's no more lava. But hearing the roiling freight train sounds of what it was like to be right at the edge of the lava lake at Halema'oma'o in that closed area with the scientists with our respirators on, but just the sound of the lava lake, how noisy it is and how, you know, powerful and hypnotic it is. That was really surprising for me to relive that because it had been, you know, several months since I'd remembered what it sounded like. So that was very surprising. And then how different the lava lake sounds from lava crossing land on the coastal plain. That's part of that lava series also is, you know, a very different sound. You know, you have this hypnotic freight train kind of sound up at the lava lake and then across the coastal plain. It's more of a sizzling snap, crackle, pop of lava moving over rock. So that was kind of a surprise to hear.
Well, I think I was struck as I was watching the coverage of the lava inundation. I remember interviews, you know, with residents who were just saying that, yes, the noise is just mm-hmm. something that was so powerful. It just gets under your skin. It's just amazing, the power of Pele.
Yes, the power of land being born and destroyed on the same, you know, on the same note. It's quite astonishing. People should definitely give it a listen. And these podcasts are on the park website as well as the NPS Nature website as well.
Jessica Farrakhan is the acting regional spokesperson for the National Park Service covering the West Coast and Pacific Islands.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
Joining us for today's reality check is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Christina Jedra. She has an interesting story about how the city overpaid some of its workers, but it's not going to try and get taxpayers' money back. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I like your headline, Keep the Change.
Yeah. So over this two-year period, the city and county of Honolulu accidentally overpaid some folks. It was 240 employees. It was a total of $98,000 due to a glitch in the payroll system, a miscalculation of people earning overtime and standby pay in the same payroll cycle.
And so, when did they catch this error, and why can't we get the money back?
So they seem to have caught it a little late. State law allows for governments that accidentally overpay employees to recoup the money within 2 years. There is some confusion on when exactly this happened, but even now the city does have an opportunity to recoup at least some of it. They've chosen not to do that. The HR director, Carolee Kubo, said that they did a cost-benefit analysis, and she didn't go into detail about that, but it seems that they're just going to cut their losses and, move on.
Any indication if, their procedures are going to change?
She did say that they've taken steps to fix their system so that this won't happen again. But there are a lot of unanswered questions on how this happened in the first place. She really didn't offer a lot of information and declined to answer questions.
Yeah, so you really didn't get a chance to interview her.
That's right. Over the course of a week, I really tried to get the HR director on the phone, and she declined to be interviewed on the phone, and also did not take questions by email. In fact, there was she took the unusual step of writing her own questions and her own answers. So she ended up interviewing herself, which means we don't have a lot of details on some unanswered questions.
Well, that is kind of odd.
Yes. What we do know is, they just decided not to recover the funds. I do have a letter from the HR director to the Hawaii Government Employees Association, and they essentially told the union, look, this was our mistake, so you can keep the money. I guess it's kind of small potatoes for the city, which has a budget of $2.8 billion with a B.
Well, what did the city council say?
I did talk with City Council Budget Chair Joey Manahan, and he said, it was disappointing. It's not what he likes to see. And also, council wasn't briefed on this, so he kind of wished that the city had come before the Budget Committee to explain what happened and how it wouldn't happen again.
Are there other council members who are concerned about this?
Yeah, I spoke with City Council Member Kimberly Pine as well, and it seems that she had some mixed feelings about it. On one hand, we definitely don't want these mistakes to happen, she said, but on the other hand, if some employees were forced to pay back a lot of money, that could be a financial hardship for them that they didn't expect.
Now, this is probably, nothing new. There have probably been this has happened in other states, other places.
Yes, I realized in my research it's kind of surprisingly common across the nation. People are human and mistakes happen. A lot of times it has to do with people cashing out sick time and vacation time when they retire. In this case, it was just a system error. And across the country, some officials have had to pay back thousands. So in the grand scheme of things, this $98,000 was on the smaller end.
Okay, but still kind of a head-scratcher as to why, they can't somehow either deduct it from future pay or I don't know. But
yes.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Christina Jedra, reporter with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Head to their website to read more about those overpayments. At the start of the school year, we offered an opportunity for the community to talk to Public School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto on a call-in show. Hawaii's the only statewide education system, and we had a wide-ranging discussion on keeping campuses safe, classrooms cool, and engaging and inspiring students. We also talked about keeping qualified teachers in the classroom. And this week, the DOE for the first time is launching an effort to get community input about teachers' salaries. The meeting started on Oahu on Monday. They'll be on Maui tonight and will wind up tomorrow on the Big Island. The superintendent has been on the job for about 2 years now, and she spent time visiting every school across the state.
So I've visited about two-thirds of our schools and hope to finish up with about 75, 80 school visits this year so that I'm actually looking at each school individually and meeting with teachers and parents and faculty members there, our leadership, and getting a firsthand view of what's happening in education.
And talk about our strategic plan, because we had talked with you earlier this summer about this rollout of the Promise Plan. Where are we at on that?
So I'm excited because we finished our first round of receiving feedback from nearly 3,000 individuals. We are taking a very different approach to our strategic plan. Rather than setting goals for the next 10 years, what we're saying is we're going to create a 10-year vision plan around five promises to students. So we're excited about these five promises. We've received feedback, and so we completed the first round on that review.
Okay, so then what's the plan as far as feedback on what you've come up with so far?
So based on the community feedback, which has been extremely positive, we are now taking that feedback to create the first full draft of the strategic plan that will give a 10-year look at our priorities. So our five promises are focused on Hawaii, really couching ourselves on our cultural and local values. Second promise is around equity, ensuring equitable access to quality education for every child in Hawaii. Our third promise is around school design, really paying attention to how each school is designed with a local context and allowing this diverse portfolio of schools approach, and we can talk further about what that means. Our fourth promise is empowerment, which is shifting empowerment to the school level so that principals and teachers and staff at the local level can make decisions and be empowered to make curriculum design decisions. And our fifth promise is around innovations, innovating in partnership with business and industry to really try to retain our youth capacity here in Hawaii, get them excited about staying here and seeing career pathways that are viable for them.
And Superintendent, what were your general impressions as you were going around the different schools?
In terms of school facilities, yeah. Catherine, our school buildings are 50 years and older, and keeping up with the demands of the facilities is quite a lift for the state, not just for the DOE, but for all of our state buildings. What I am finding is when I am going to schools and meeting with custodians and meeting with the local team, they are doing a fantastic job of maintaining buildings as best they can. At the same time, keeping up with what classrooms need, and bathrooms, roofs, paving, those are things that are very evident to, you know, when you go onto a campus, the kind of need they have. So we are, you know, we're all over the place. We have schools that have been updated, and we appreciate the legislature's support and funding on an annual basis. Last year, they gave us the greatest funding that we've had in terms of our CIP allocation, so we appreciate that. And they also tied in our job order contracting work with how they are providing funding. So we're also pleased with $70 million for the year that we have to expend through job order contracting. So that's there holding us to what we said we're going to be doing on expediting some of these projects. But schools are managing within what they have. And for the schools that are our older buildings that have had the least amount of work done on it, yes, you can see the wear and tear. At the same time, what I'm seeing instructionally is fantastic. And I do, you know, give a shout out to my teachers and principals and custodial staff and support staff for the tremendous work that they're doing to support community and create these positive environments.
Can we talk about the teacher shortage? I mean, what needs to be done in order to deal with this? Because, you know, at all levels, we just need the teachers. And I know as a parent, I want a passionate teacher. I want someone who loves, you know, what they're doing. I mean, I recall at Wilson, there was a fabulous teacher, Mrs. Waukee. A shout out to her, you know, and she's probably still teaching. And I want a teacher that's engaged, that cares about the students, not someone who just wants an easy job and is going to play substitute.
if you want an easy job, it's not teaching, I tell you that much, and you can speak to any of our kumu. I will say that we have incredible teachers in the Department of Ed. The challenge is we don't have enough of them. And also the challenge is that teaching in the public education system continues to become more and more complex as we look to also provide a lot of community supports and services to our public education systems. And I really need my teachers to be focused on creating that great instructional environment, which means that there are also non-teacher roles that we really need support around, and we need to provide that opportunity to hire those partners to come in and work with us. But in the classroom, we have, you know, a demand of 1,200, 1,300 teachers that we need a year due to retirement, and also teachers going on to other roles. And I think thinking about teaching as a lifelong profession, we have to think differently today. We have young people who go into teaching, MA, 10 years into teaching, want to switch careers. And that happens across every industry. And we shouldn't think that teaching is, you know, exempt from the fact that employees are working in very different ways in community today, making decisions to work two or three career paths. And so we have to think differently about how we structure these opportunities. But we're also an island state, which means we can't recruit from across, you know, the state lines from someone else. You know, there's a lot of kind of borrowing and stealing from each other on the mainland, and that doesn't happen here. We have to grow our own teachers, and we do have a grow your own teacher program here. We thank the legislators, especially Senator Kidani, who's been at the forefront of ensuring we get funding for this program. We have a troops to teacher program, so military retirees often retiring at a very young age, looking for a second career, helping them to understand the pathway to come into teaching or to have their spouses come into teaching. We also have a program of teacher academies at our high schools that we're growing to help our high school students start their teacher certification program while in high school so that we can retain our own students to remain in teaching in this profession here in Hawaii and to see it as a viable career path.
What about the pay? Because, you know, it is pretty shocking, you know, when you see how much you have to make in order to not be considered low income in Hawaii. And it's very difficult with the housing challenges, you know, better pay for teachers so they're more competitive out there, because we don't want to see a brain drain. You know, we do see teachers leave.
Absolutely. So we see teachers who live in more of a joint ohana environment. They have that network and support. When we have our other teachers who don't necessarily have a multi-family kind of home environment, house environment, they're trying to rent or buy on their own, that teacher pay does not go far enough. And one of the things I found in the last two legislative sessions that I've been involved with is that I need very specific data to go to the legislature with to talk about what the delta is between our current pay and competitive pay that will help to mitigate this gap, this teacher gap right now. And so I've contracted actually with a third party to do a study on Hawaii teacher pay that will be available in December that will take into consideration and adjust for cost of living in Hawaii. And it's that study that I will use, our HSTA, our teachers union will use as well. I'll be sharing that with them to go to the legislature to say, This is the delta. This is the amount of money we need to have a competitive salary and also a salary that allows viability to live here in Hawaii. We want to retain that capacity.
Are we doing anything to attract more teachers to the rural areas where there might be fewer teachers, qualified teachers interested in going?
Absolutely. So we do have differentiated pay, and we have stipends anywhere from $3 all the way up to $10,000 of additional pay, hard to fill, or if you have national board certification, we are providing those differentials, and they help. At the same time, the pipeline of future teachers is not filled enough, so we produce about 600 teachers a year, but DOE alone needs about 1,300. So that doesn't count the private schools who are also looking for teachers. And so we're not producing enough teachers here in our state for the demand.
And I know at one time, the University of Hawaii Board of Regents met with the Department of Education School Board to talk about how can we help the College of Education produce more teachers and higher quality teachers and to get certified teachers.
Absolutely. And University of Hawaii is a major partner with us in this work and also continues to look at new certification areas. We have a new commitment towards instruction K-12 in computer science, which means another demand area in addition to other teacher demands that we have. And so working with the University of Hawaii around these preparation programs. I also think that as a state, as a system, we need to be willing to think about teacher certification in a very different way. We have a system that's been around forever, right, nationally. And I think we need to think differently about how you access a teacher line, how you get trained while teaching, and create different flexibilities in our policy structure.
You've been listening to School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto. It was part of a call-in show aired at the beginning of the year, of the school year. You can listen back to the entire hour on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us this morning. Now back over to Pledge Central.